Accession number 27226, Reel 25.
Line on hook, Reel 25.
Okay. All right, so we've now really looked at the accommodation. We can't do much about it except that it was civilized. We were quite comfortable, and the airfield itself was tiny, so we really get to next stage of life there and flying. Life there was very pleasant, and apart from the food, because we're alongside a lagoon, so we had a boat and we could go and sail on the lagoon and go fishing. Which comes up again later on in the flying aspect, but fortuitous, but that was Godfrey's business. Right, so we've now got a situation where there's not many of us there. There'd be about six other people, and Jack Dyson and myself, and Shorty Curran hadn't. He'd gone down to fly with the expediters to learn to fly and be taught to fly properly. And to teach other people how to do it as well, under Godfrey's expert tuition. So the first thing that happened was that I went out to fly Jewel in Harvard with a man called Newt Beers, he was from a squadron, and he was flying Corsairs, quite a good pilot, trained in America, and his job was to take me up and give me a familiarization again with fighter aircraft and everything else. The first time in my life I was sick. The first time. I took this aeroplane up in the sky and threw it around a little bit. No real problem, really, except he was a typical fighter pilot. He flew an aeroplane, didn't worry about what the engine did or anything else. He just flew the aeroplane and bashed it around something. But that was fine. But we flew around a little bit, and then all of a sudden, my engine stopped. What do you do? Well, you go through the normal procedures, I suppose. You look at everything, see what's what. But I never even got a hold of the throttle to find out where it was, and I had a dead engine. With an instruction from the back, your engine stopped, hokey-do, forced landing. And I thought it was for real. We're over the airfield, so I was doing a forced landing. The airfield was not near enough to do a forced landing on, and the option was to land on the coconut trees or take a punt. There was nothing else. It was in amongst the coconut trees, and we went down. And of course, as you're doing a forced landing with no engine, your engine gets colder from the height. And normally you've got to give it a burst every so often, but to me it was a dead engine, had nothing. And so I sat there looking for the best place, and I sat down to land on top of the coconut trees. And I was sitting there waiting for what to me was the end, really. I was going to land amongst the trees, God knows what would happen. And suddenly, just above the tops of the trees, which we clipped, the engine burst into flames, as it were. He sat in the back, never said a word all that time. And he chopped the throttle. He closed the throttle and said, do a forced landing. And of course, there's no place to do a forced landing, you know? And which I did, looking around for something else. And it was a question of chicken. And if he hadn't opened that throttle, we would have been coconut fodder or whatever it is. And so that was my first introduction to flying with Blears. Now, the corollary of that story is that the squadron was there, and they were still working up with the CO. And I told you about the big lake just beyond things. And they were flying over there. He was number two to number one over the lake. Now, if you're flying early in the day in the tropics, the sea is glassy calm, and you have no idea what your level is at all. You have no visual acuity. You can be right on the top of it and you don't realise it was there. And he was inside his number two, and CO did a turn with him on the inside, and they're right on the water, and he went straight in and was killed. That was within 24 hours of my going to Putnam. which was rather a hairy introduction. So that was strange one. But then after that, the squadrons just came in. They worked up. They did deck landings. There was a carrier out in a carrier somewhere out for doing deck landings. I know nothing at all about it. I don't even know which one it was. But facilities were available for deck landing training. The airfield being so small, and all the conditions leading up to it were ideal for that, but hairy, but dangerous, but it was enough. And so we then got into the routine of flying and living, and generally getting on with our lives, I suppose. We flew, Jack Dyson and I flew, because we're buddies together, we flew all the time. And one thing we didn't know, that Godfrey taught us everything about it, every fighter work generally, and one thing that had been cancelled from a point of view of exercises were head-on training for head-on attacks. They told you about head-on attacks, but they never did any, but they forgot to tell Godfrey that they didn't train anybody to do it. And we're sitting there, stooging for all the other boys, and doing it ourselves, doing head-on attacks. And if you've done a head-on attack once, it's hairy. If you have to do it as an exercise, a training exercise, that isn't funny. Because when you think you're two big aircraft approaching you, that probably at a good 200 knots, you've got a 400 knots differential, and you've got to come within a 200-yard range of the aircraft to hit it. And in order to hit it, with your, you've got to set off your, you know, it's off-shooting. You're not firing at an aircraft that you can avoid and go away. You have to fly on a collision course all the time to get in there and do the attacks and then break away. And that is not humorous at all. And we had to do it. We were doing it all the time. Between ourselves, Jack and I were doing it. And used to sweat cobs because it was worrying, you know, to say the least. And we did that all day and every day. I mean, that's an exaggeration in some, to some extent, but we did a hell of a lot of it. We had the lake, which was always there for us, and Godfrey's, because the sun was shining, Godfrey's favourite idea for quarter attacks was that one would fly about, difficult to say, probably 500 feet above the sea, not much, but enough. Throwing a shadow on the water, and you do quarter attacks with live guns on the shadow in the water. A very good exercise, but very, very knuckle, you know. And that was beyond the realm, really. You wouldn't be allowed to do it nowadays. It was just too crazy. But that's what we did, and we did that all the time.
Have there been any changes in fighter tactics since your initial training in the UK on them?
Well, yes, there was a slight difference, because bear in mind that with a fighter aircraft, you're in there by yourself. You don't usually have an instructor in the situation where the instructor is really the enemy. And we went through this, of course. I remember at Yeovilton with Dickie, you suddenly have to learn that an aeroplane is a consumable piece of kit, whatever you might think. And it's no good to you if you're not using it properly. And but when you're learning to fly, you're taught to be gentle with the aircraft, to fly it properly. Don't overdrive the engine, fly it smoothly and everything else. You'll not survive if you do that as a fighter pilot. And one of the first things you do is realise that you've got a throttle there, you've got a big engine, and use it. And if your engine blows up, that's hard luck, because it's better the engine blows up than somebody's broken the other way. And a concept that probably isn't often transmitted to people, that suddenly you've been taught to fly an aircraft safely and properly and get it back. But up there, if you haven't got an aircraft to bring back safe, you might forget it. And so you don't worry about over-revving or anything like that, or what you do with it. You're in there, you've got a piece of kit, you've got a stick, you've got rudders and everything else, and you can do things with it. And it's not flying per se, but it's escaping or making certain you're in the right place at the right time. an indication of that, and this is personal and ego, but I, when was it with Dickie? I don't think I've ever mentioned this to you, but Dickie Cork was good, and he was, he used to come on the quarter attack. I can always see it, this propeller, and when he was there, I knew I was dead, you know, that was it. And that was in the early days. And they said, Gordon, he said, if you sit like that, he said, you'll never get anywhere, because if people, you just have to move. And the next time he came along, I knew where he was, you know, he was in there for since, and I knew he'd come down as a quarter attack. And I always remember this, because he said, that's the way to fly an airplane. He was coming in, I could see him over there, I've whammed open the throttle full, I was on full course, and he came up round, and he was coming down, and I was doing a, going like a bat out of hell, I pulled the stick up, do a sort of a slow, not a slow roll, a roll over the top, and he actually flew underneath me. He couldn't control himself, and came back, and when he came back, I was there on his tail, I'd changed places with him. Little things like that, that you can only be taught when you've done it wrong with somebody who recognises what you've done wrong and says the solution here, Hooky, is just don't worry about your bloody engine, don't worry about the aircraft, just fly the sodding thing.
So by the time you were in Ceylon, were you passing that ethos on to the pilots that you...
That's our job, with? Yes. We were there. We were... Jack and I would do fill-ins. We were there to, you know, with dog's bodies, really. If the Navy wanted to do anything, we did it. And when we were down there, now in the fighter pool proper, with half a flying experience, with fighter trained, with boys who are trained in America, flying Corsairs and everything else, and we were teaching them as they were teaching us. It was a cross-fertilisation, but that was our job, just for a short spell.
With that, were you practising formation flying at all? While you were doing the fighter?
Well, you didn't practice for most. I mean, you just did it. I mean, the answer to that is not really formation flying. I mean, it was when you flew two, so you never flew close to formation, type formation, or anything like that.
And what about this introduction to new flying kit? What was that?
Well, while we were there, one of the problems, of course, in flying, and especially with the new high-speed aircraft, was that you blacked out if you did a tight turn or in certain conditions. And in all, the reason you blacked out was that gravity took all the blood from your head down to your feet. And the concept was the Frank suit, which is filled with water. And you put this thing on, fill it with water, and tighten it all up, so that if you got into a tight turn, you didn't black out so quickly. And they were uncomfortable in the tropics, so not a comfortable piece of kit at all. But they certainly worked. You could certainly pull an aircraft back and you didn't go, didn't get blackouts or anything like that. You didn't go grey for a long, long time. It was a useful piece of kit. And at the same time, we were introduced to bone domes, which they were something quite unique, which everybody has nowadays when they're even driving a bike. But these are plastic helmets, which we wore with oxygen masks as well. They were a bit cumbersome, really, a bit of a nuisance in many ways. But in the event of a crash landing, for instance, anything like that, it protected your head, you know, and I had that problem all those years ago at Errol, when we had that crash. And actually, if I'd have had one of those, that would have probably helped to save me, but I had my goggles down as it was, so, you know. But if in that situation, the first part of your head that fits the dashboard or fits the front is where the bone dome was, so it saved you that way. The funny thing about it was that story, or anecdote about that, was that when you'd been flying with the damn thing, all you wanted was get him off. A bit of a bloody nuisance. And the story, I don't know the background to that story at all, but it was in Colombo, and one of the boys had been flying with a front suit, and he came back, and he was all hot and sweaty and cold. He'd probably been up in the sun, because it used to get very hot in those cockpits. And he got out of the aircraft, got out and sat on the edge of the wing, and then did the taps of his G-suit, so that the water could come out. And there was a wren there who complained bitterly to him for exposing himself in front of wrens, reported him to the senior queen bee, who came along and gave him a right rolling for peeing when he got out of his aircraft, all he was doing was taking the water out of his frank suit. Yeah. Never heard that one. No. It's quite a unique story, really, but you have the conditions right, you see. That was in Ceylon. It wouldn't have happened to us, because we didn't have any wrens, of course, in Putlam. I don't think there are any wrens at all on Putlam at any time. But don't forget, I wasn't there very long.
So how was the move to Jannah Bay affected? How did you move?
Well, what happened was that by this time I'd gone past my sell-by date. Normally, a deep tropical 6 months, you're home, and that was West Africa out of the way. I should have gone home then, the two of us. But no, there was no place for us. They wanted three fighter pilots down at Simonstown. Off we go to Simonstown. So we're no longer deep tropical, the 6 months gone, and instead of going home, thank God, we went to Cape Town. From there...
So you went back to South Africa?
No, that's... I'm telling you why, the reason why, the six months, and then we got lost in this business of South Africa, East Africa, closing the fighter pool, waiting around in Mombasa with all the problems with the Japanese sub and all that nonsense. All part and parcel of the requirement at that time gradually extended it from 6 months to a year to 18 months. And Godfrey is a stickler. If you've done your 18 months, you went home because that was your right. In fact, that was a question of the Corsair. You remember the Corsair business? Well, that's why he flew his Corsair home. He said, I'm time expired, I want to go home. And the war was over, I think, then, like that. But he set off. And so I'd done 18 months. I was a fighter boy. The School of Naval Air Warfare was the next thing. So he said, do you want to go home, do the ADO course, promotion, and come back again? Yeah, fine. You know, I had a wife back there I hadn't seen for nearly 18 months then. And almost on the button, after 18 months, I think I left in July, I think. That was 18 months' time to go home. You don't waste time, you just don't sit around because you're waiting for ships. So they sent me off to China Bay to await passage home. And that was it, really. I was just waiting to get home, and I got to China Bay. And that really sorts out Putlam, except we did a bit Bulbo once when for the fleet, for some reason, where we had all the aircraft in Ceylon all flying around, milling around like aeroplanes amongst the clouds and everything. It's quite a big one. Don't know what it was all about, but we were in it anyway. Life in Ceylon overall was very pleasant because we were free. We were able to do what we liked. We were pretty well a free agent. Have I told you about the trip we took the squadron up to the hills to Kandy? Oh well. He was a lad for keeping the squadron happy and decided that we'd have a run ashore or a run up to camp. Putlam wasn't all death and disaster by any means, but we had a squadron there, and not a big one, that was just really working up. And Godfrey decided that it was moral boosting to do a trip in the hills to Kandy to see what the island was like and give the boys a day out. Because one always must always remember, and I see this quite a lot to people, that we had the glamour, we had the bits and pieces, but the lads who did the hard work were the boys who kept the aircraft going. And even in the tropics, it's not funny. And there was dust, and Godfrey would... We used to stirrup pump petrol into the over to the engine when they were cold to get rid of all the dirt and dust that was in the cylinders, you know, the cylinders. Quite that sort of thing. And these lads worked hard. You saw it particularly how hard it was when they got into Carrier, where the boys were in the tropics. literally in a tin can, and they were cooked all the time. And then if they went on Atlantic convoys or anything like that, they froze to death, you know. And they were working in conditions that were inhuman. I mean, in the tropics, it was hot, sweaty all the time. In the Atlantic convoys, they were working with fingers that were bloody frozen, you know. And people haven't said enough about that, really. That's something that could... but, again, we're back to Putlam. So I decided to take the boys up to Kandy, so we hired a bus and set off. Now, it's all right, but you hire a bus in Ceylon, but you don't get single-ease drivers. So we had a bus, and somebody had to drive a bus all the way to Kandy. Now, Kandy is in the hills, and if you know Ceylon, even the railway trains go around corners very sharp, and we set off to Kandy. And it's a group of sailors all going up for a day out. They got all the necessary equipment, and they set out. They're quite happy. They went up on the hill and into Kandy and did whatever they did in Kandy. Went to the Temple of the Tooth and all that sort of business, quite jolly. Can't remember a great deal about it myself, even though I don't drink. But it was an interesting day out, marked particularly by the fact that the driver who was actually driving had never driven a bus before, and he was going to drive us back. Nobody in the whole squadron could drive a bus. And when we came back, we picked up an Australian and a Canadian, I think, to come back to Columbia. I think we were set off. No, we must have set off from Putlam. Doesn't matter. We set off to go back wherever, and it was hairy. Down the hills, round the corners, and there came a stage where the boys all wanted to stop to get rid of all the bits and pieces that they acquired in Kandy, and so they all got out there, and these two boys bailed out completely. They refused point blank to be driven by a whole squadron of naval characters trying to get home in a bus with a drunken driver who had never driven a bloody bus before. That was not funny. Well, we got back all right, but that was a good day out, quite memorable in many ways. That was Godfrey, you see. We'd fly 400 miles to go and get the eggs. He managed to get scampi from the places. And the fish in Ceylon was beautiful. I mean, the best fish restaurant was at halfway between Putnam and Colombo, and the food there was magnificent. I'll tell you about that when I'm coming back home. So, really, you can go on about Putlam. It was really an interlude for us, where we were waiting. We'd done our time. We were filling in the intake of the American. There were normally New Zealand pilots who were coming, trained in America, coming through to be graded up for full operational standards and to land anywhere and do anything.
You said, though, that China Bay was a different type of airfield in the fact that it was much more operational. Was it a bigger airfield?
It was an RAF airfield, for starters. China Bay is a particular interest, and I'm going on an awful lot about these things, but China Bay was a big airfield that was being extended specifically for the Americans. And I'll deal with that now, because we're going to China Bay, we can draw blind over Putlam. But I think that's all the highlights there. We did well, we were there, just a matter of interest. We went into the jungle and we found the crashed aircraft that was there with the body of a Japanese pilot, not far from the airfield. Nobody had ever seen it before. We walked in there and there it was, the skeleton and everything else with the...
Why had you gone into the jungle? Why had you gone into the jungle?
It crashed. It just crashed.
But why had you gone into the jungle? Was there any reason for it?
Just go around. We're just having a look around, really.
Had he crashed a couple of years before then?
Oh, he crashed He crashed and nobody had known about it, of course, when the Japanese attacked Ceylon, and when we evacuated the place. We left Ceylon completely and came back to East Africa. So it was not a naval operation. Ceylon was dead, apart from Godfrey making Putlam go and whatever else the Navy was doing. It was ceased to be an operational activity in Colombo until we went back again.
Okay, well, tell me about China Bay. You were just about to say about it was being extended.
China Bay was a big runway. It was the longest supported runway ever built. It was 3,700 yards, if I remember rightly, and it extended across an isthmus where there's the harbour at one end, and the other end was either the end of a river or a lake. Certainly, you took off at the bottom end, what I call the bottom end. There's the harbour where all the ships were, and at the other end was a long lake. About this is dealing with the American side. And the aircraft itself was made and connected to the oil depot with a fuel supply, which was a series of standard pipes all around the airfield for refueling aircraft. And the whole object of this exercise was for the American Super Force, which had just come along, to do a long raid from Ceylon to Pelambang in Sumatra. You know of Pelambang because that was the one that was squashed later on. Now, this was ultimately an exercise of absolute futility, for which they spent mega money to take 52 aircraft to drop some bombs on Pelambang and right out. It shows, to some extent, the ineffectiveness of mass bombing. And I'll deal with this story in its entire context, because it was a major change in the war change in the war activities, as you'll see when I deal with it. So we go to China Bay, and we're filling in time, so we fly anything, do anything, go anywhere, do whatever anybody wants us to do. And so we're on this lovely airfield, a big airfield, no problem landing and everything else. And we were put in charge of a Walrus as a safety aircraft for this big raid from Pelambang by Super Force, aircraft that nobody had ever seen before, never knew about. They were had a pressurized pilot cabin, could fly all over, you know, anywhere, do anything. The big job. They arrived en masse and in toto from central India, and they went straight to the fuel points and refueled just by connecting hose pipes to the aircraft, to these mushrooms alongside, turned the tap on, they refueled a whole super fort in about 20 minutes. Just the whole fort, the whole lot. So you can imagine the infrastructure that they put in there. Nobody knew used those. We couldn't use them. They arrived. They set off. Now, we knew the CO, and he said that they'd never had a takeoff up to that time where they hadn't had an accident on takeoff, because they were carrying nothing else but fuel and one bomb, and the bomb was no bigger than the swordfish could carry. And they were going to fly 52 of these super forts from China Bay in Ceylon to Pelambang in Sumatra, drop the bombs, set the place fire or something else, and come back.